Today's program has been brought to you by Hearst Ranch, the nation's largest single-source supplier of free-range, all-natural, grass-fed, and grass-finished beef. For more information, visit HearstRanch.com. Broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn, you're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
Welcome, everybody. This is the sweet voice of Patrick Martins, host of The Main Course. It is a big day here at Heritage Radio Network and at Roberta's, as we have our first annual fundraiser. So we got a bunch of restaurants coming: Gramercy Tavern, Parish Hall, Del Posto, Roberta's, of course, Back 40 West, Essex Street Market has a table here. So it's a big event, a couple hundred people coming to the back farm of Roberta's. And so I was thinking this would be a great show to just have some of the, you know, co-founders, the group of people that first believed in this station and helped bring it to where it is today on. So it's kind of like a story about beginnings. So I'll introduce them in a second, I can say it quickly. I remember all your names. Aaron Fairbanks is the executive director. Next in line, Katie Kiefer is like one of the, she was my co-host for a couple of years. So we interviewed all these great people together. Brian Kenny, she's also a host of Straight No Chaser, which is after this. Brian Kenny, who really is the person who's known about the station for the longest, because a lot of it got conceived during some early morning breakfasts that we had here with Steve Hearst. And we'll talk about that. And of course, Jack Inslee, who has put more man hours in the producer station than anyone. He's tagged every show, basically. He's like a little Google himself. You're like, who was the third in line pastry chef of Antonucci's in 1986? He's like, Pierce Brosnan. I'm like, got it. So, beginnings. I've been involved in some exciting beginnings. I've always loved beginnings. You know, once things get set and settled and systematized and standard operating procedurized, I lose a little interest. But slow food was fascinating at the beginning. You know, opening new chapters around the country, the excitement of first meetings, you know, after talking to people on the telephone for a year and then you finally meet them for a big event, you know, from voice to reality. The nerves before big events, the publication of our first newsletter and wondering what people would think about it, and, you know, growing from 1,000 members to 2,000 to 3 to 4 and on. It was super exciting. Heritage Foods USA is a kind of other movement, and the beginning for me with that was meeting all these chefs and trying all these unbelievable new foods and, you know, going out all the time and, you know, learning about how brilliant these chefs are. And then from the farm and slaughter perspective, figuring out the animal, lessons learned about how to improve use of using the whole carcass, you know, meeting truck drivers on some highway in New Jersey for the first time and being like, you're going to be our guy for the next 10 years, driving all our pallets of beef and pork. You know, it was so exciting. Even like the excitement of finding an outlet for our hams. That's 7,000 pounds a week, and Sam Edwards helped us. And now HRN is very much at that same kind of percolating, explosive, exciting stage. And that's why I'm so happy to have you guys on. And I want to talk about that feeling, because it's so much unknown, and yet there's so much already happened. So I guess I'll just go around. We'll start with you, Aaron, and talk to me about, you know, beginnings as it relates to the network.
Well, I think that you hit the nail on the head. It's interesting to come in. I've been on the part of the organization for the last 2 years as host of the Farm Report. So it was interesting to step into this new role and kind of take a moment to look beyond my own show and think, well, how does the network present more globally? Where are the holes in our program? Where are the really great shows? Where are the people that we're going to work with a little bit more to develop the content? And how do we systemize and organize? I mean, I think one of the cool things about beginnings is that there's a big opportunity for just a lot of creative energy, and of getting a lot of great people in one room and seeing what shakes out of it. And as an organization ages, you're looking at building in the things you talked about earlier, systems and procedures, and how do you kind of organize it in a way that makes it easy to communicate about what you're doing. I think that's something that, you know, now that we have received nonprofit status, people are asking us a lot, you know, what's your mission? What's your vision? What's your budget look like? All of a sudden people want answers for the next, not just week as it has been, but for the next 5 years, 10 years. They want to know who we're looking to for advice and guidance, and hosts want to know what the change means, if anything. So I think it's been a lot about just trying to stay quiet and listen to a lot of programs. I know Jack has had the benefit in his role as executive producer of hearing most of the shows, having a really strong relationship with all of the hosts. And so I had a lot of catching up to do, just literally getting to know people and getting a chance to listen to all the shows. And so it's been nice to sit down with everyone, check in, and take some time to really think critically about what that means for us going forward.
Very, very interesting. So next in line is Katie Kiefer, who, you know, was blessed enough to work with me every Sunday, and I know how much you love that.
I certainly did.
But now you have a much stronger show, so Straight No Chaser. No, I mean, it's like, it's our powerhouse political show, and it stands with NPR powerhouse political shows and all that. You
Thanks,
have great
Patrick.
Guests. So tell us about your impressions.
Well, I think that when I started working with you, Patrick, it was really because I'd been sent out here, as you recall, to interview you by Michael Batterbury for Food Arts Magazine. And the reason Michael sent me is that a year or two before that, I had said to him that I longed to develop a show that was about the food system and not necessarily about chefs or restaurants, but of course included that, but that was my dream. And how, you know, did he think that would ever happen, that there would be a radio network that would be interested enough in food systems and food politics to take on somebody like me as a host? Lo and behold, when you started Heritage Radio Network, he had kept that in the back of his mind for all that time. It must have been a year and a half, 2 years. And as soon as you started Heritage Radio Network, Michael sent me out here to interview you, and the rest is history. And I mean, as far as how the station started, I mean, just kind of scrambling around, we really did do it by the seat of our pants. I mean, there was absolutely no money. There were very few hosts. It was all this incredible sort of work in progress with ideas coming from all kinds of places. And yet, thanks to your work with Slow Food and Heritage Foods USA, there was enough of a reputation for gravitas there that we were able to get some really great guests and to start attracting some really incredible hosts. And the network has been built out since then, and including some, you know, ever more important and interesting people who bring in ever more important and interesting guests. It's really been a thrill to be part of this whole ride. And I've loved absolutely every minute of it. And in the coming years, I only see it going further. I mean, as one of the things that Heritage Radio Network has done, I think, is build a much stronger awareness in the population of where our food comes from and who's making it, and what things are important when you go to the grocery store, what's important about the choices that you make about how you feed yourself. And the whole sort of DIY and urban gardening and all of that stuff has come, I think, largely as part of that sort of explosion of information from Heritage, but also it's fed Heritage at the same time. So I just see that synergy growing nationally. And I, you know, I'm waiting for, you know, some of the bigger radio stations to recognize that this radio station online is a force of education and information, as well as, you know, just plain entertainment, that really should be part of broadband as well as internet radio. And, you know, it's only a matter of time. It's going to happen.
So how has your interviewing changed over the years? Because now you probably interviewed 500 guests.
Oh, at least.
Yeah. So at how least. Have you changed as an interviewer?
Well, I do a whole lot more preparation than I used to. I write a very detailed show outline before my show. But mostly it's really about the preparation. I do an enormous amount of reading, and I have, I'm, you know, subscribed to at least a dozen trade blogs about food innovation, food politics. I follow a lot of different writers. And as a result, I'm developing relationships with people who are not so visible to the external world who are calling the shots about our food system. I mean, people who are insiders in the cattle industry who, you know, you wouldn't think of normally as your everyday household word, but these are people who have a profound impact on some of the things that affect the way we eat and how we shop. Mm-hmm. Same goes with politics and politicians. Those people are, you know, I can't just call up a politician and you know, blow it up my rear end. I got to actually have some substance there. I have to have done some reading. And, you know, and people like Marion Nestle is another person who has complimented me over and over again on the preparation that I do, unlike so many of the other radio programs that she's been on in the, you know, in the last decade or more. So it's, that's
including
the stuff,
mine.
Yeah, that's the stuff that pays off, though. And the more I learn about my, you know, what I'm interested in, the better I can interview subjects and the more information I can bring out for the listening audience. And that's
who's
that's
on what your show today.
Actually, today I have the wonderful Andy Smith, professor of food studies at the New School.
He's your Marv Albert. Whenever David Letterman didn't have guests, Marv would
He's not on often enough, actually. I mean, I love Andy Smith. He's unbelievably knowledgeable about food history, and he has a new book out about the tuna fish and how it became a national icon. And it has a lot to do with how fishing regulations started and a whole sort of anti-Japanese sentiment that swept the country long before Pearl Harbor. I mean, there's a lot of really interesting stuff in there that has had an impact on subsequent years.
We interviewed him once, and it was about how the South starved to death.
That's right.
And that it was starvation.
And that's what lost the Civil War.
Yeah, interesting.
That was great, yeah. Temple Grandin next week, by the way.
Yeah. Temple Grandin. Wow. She's the best. I love Temple Grandin. You're like, what are the issues with slaughterhouses today in America? She's like, there's three issues. One, the curves, you know, like, and she just gets it. And she answers questions that would take some people 2 hours to answer. She answers in 30 seconds because she has such a sophisticated understanding of the issue. So Brian Kenny from Hearst Ranch or Hearst Corporation. Is that what?
Yeah, either.
Welcome.
Hearst Ranch Beef, Hearst Corporation. Thank you, Patrick.
So you've been a friend of mine for years, well before Heritage Radio Network started. So tell us about your beginnings at Heritage Radio and your poignant memories.
Well, I'm sitting here at Roberta's, and I'm looking at an empty table in a place that I believe the first time I was here, I don't even know if it was paved in the back of Roberta's. And I think it's a really good metaphor because my involvement with the Heritage Radio Network started with a call from you, Patrick, and anybody that is in Patrick's orbit knows these calls. Dude, we got to start a radio station. What? No, really. No, I've got this idea. I can tell you all about it. All I need is $5,000 to get some containers. You know, I got them ordered. So it's like, so many things with you, Patrick. It starts with a leap of faith, but now we're in the studio. It's built out. How many shows do you have? 30?
25 plus, yeah.
And in terms of what the radio network represents to me, it's like a beacon of freedom in programming and content development, just from a media perspective. Where are you going to find shows like this? They're not the kind of things that would pass a pitch committee at a media company, because what every show on this network has in common is a host who's passionate about it and guests who are passionate. And that's something you can't fake. And to your point, Katie, about your preparation, I find it interesting. I know that you subscribe to Meeting Place, which is near and dear to my heart.
I love Meeting Place.
Yes, and you watch all the industry stuff that's going on, and you have a deep understanding of it. And that's just not something that anybody could be incented to do at a mainstream media outlet, even NPR. I mean, they're old model media, and what you guys are doing here is the new model that doesn't exist yet, but it's heavily DIY, obviously. But the production quality is incredible. I mean, it's legit. This is a real deal.
So how did you first sell it to the Hearst Ranch? You know, I mean, was that a tough sell? Or what argument did you make to, you know, get them to be our biggest donors for the first few years?
You know, you have a good name in Heritage. We've done business with you guys, so it wasn't much of a stretch. But I think everything made sense when I brought Steve Hurst out here for a pork chop at 9 in the morning. And we were driving out here, and he said, are you taking me to bump me off? Where the hell are we? We're out by the cement plant, and, you know, and it was a gray day. It was kind of rainy, as I recall. And then I said, look, just suspend disbelief for 20 minutes. Let's go inside. And I remember Brandon was here. Chris was here. Mm-hmm. You were here. And we just had a really good meal. And he said afterwards, you know, he got it. You can't categorize what's happening out here.
Now, the Hearst don't get credit for this, by many people. They people know them as the publication people, but they built the first green skyscraper post 9/11.
Yeah, absolutely, the Hearst Tower on West 57th.
And they're very concerned with, or they're very cutting edge on all those issues that are so important to HRN.
Yeah, well, the funny thing about it is, a lot of the families that are involved in agriculture and timber, which the Hearst family has been, that's where they started, really, with Senator George Hearst. Those people have owned land for a really long time, and they are deeply concerned with sustainability because it's a practical consideration, part of their DNA. Mm-hmm. People that have owned land for a long time tend to be concerned about it as it's their home. Mm-hmm. And I think it's really easy in the 24-hour news cycle. And certainly in, you know, with some of the things that have happened in popular culture and Occupy and all this stuff, everything's a tweet or a bumper sticker. But what I value about my life professionally is that I tend to exist in a gray area. I mean, we're a grass-fed beef company. Most grass-fed beef consumers could be categorized under the anti-corporate mindset. We're definitely a corporation run by a family trust and producing grass-fed beef on 150,000 acres of rangeland. So, but it fits really well into what Hearst Corporation's all about.
Cool. And then we'll come back to you, Brian. It's thank you for sharing that. And Jack Inslee from Long Island.
Oh, man, really?
Born and raised in New York.
Unfortunately so.
Tell us about your poignant memories.
I believe it was like November 2009 that I went to the Spotted Pig with Nat Wiener, and okay. He was all stressed out, and he's like, I got to meet this guy, Patrick. I got emailed about this radio station. Can you come in case I need a backup or something? And I was like, really? He's like, yeah. So I put a nice shirt on and showed up. I think the first thing you said is, oh, are you guys partners? And we were like, no, just roommates.
Well, you both look so, that nice shirt.
It was the shirt. You
know, yeah, it was so clean and folded.
So I met you and Sarah Obritis, and I remember both of you going a mile a minute about what this would be, and you had the grand vision, and then she was saying things like, and I'm going to do a show about food and music, and there'll be turntables, and I'll play songs, and I'll have musicians. And I was like, wow, this is... I left and I said, I wonder if that's ever going to happen. And sure enough, Nat, a few months later, can you come back me up? Can you come help out? Slowly but surely, I did more and more shows, and here we are. It's incredible for me to see all of these hosts who had no real media training to speak of and to chart that progress over 3 years or so. Mm-hmm. It's like just... I mean, and even Katie, your show, even just the way you speak, your cadences, the way you frame questions, it all just is naturally improving. So that's really great to watch, and it's nice to have a place where there's freedom for that to happen. And then
now, tell me, more than anybody, you have witnessed like Roberta's has basically been your home. I mean, you would spend 8 hours a day here. How has this restaurant transformed from the staff to the menu to the feel since basically you were here a year after they opened?
Well, the core is still intact, which I think is pretty awesome. All of those founding members of Roberta's are still here. I can't really think of anybody, even Christian and Ty and Bonnie and all these original servers, they're all still here.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, save for a few that went to travel. So I love the fact that they've all remained intact. And I knew nothing about food coming into this. So I've kind of learned, I feel like, along with our audience, just listening to all these shows. I remember, for me, the most important memory was, I don't know if you remember this, Chris Carpenter was here, and we had a dinner here. I think Chris Carpenter is a Napa Valley chapter leader for
Slow
Food,
he's the chairman of the board, actually. He became, no longer, he just resigned.
Okay. Yeah, and we had a meal here, and I knew nothing about food. I was a picky eater, and he just welcomed me, and he said, Jack, eat these Hen of the Woods mushrooms. They're amazing. Just eat this. And I said, all right, you know what? I'll eat all these things. And it all kind of made sense sitting at a big table like that and just taking chances.
Fantastic. Well, today is a big party. You have 200 people. So, Aaron and Jack, tell us about... I mean, can people still buy tickets?
Yeah, there are a few tickets left. If you want to buy them, you can go to heritageradionetwork.eventbrite.com. Because you're listening, we know you are friends and family, so please feel free to use the discount code, which is FF50 for $50 off, and then show up. 5 o'clock, we'll be kicking in the backyard. We have Binky Griptite and friends coming to spin some records and do a little bit of emceeing for us. We have food from some of the city's best chefs. A couple of my old friends, my old boss Mike Anthony from Gramercy Tavern. We've got Matt Weingarten, who's author of Preserving Wild Foods and is working from within the Sodexo system to do sustainability work inside of one of the world's largest food corporations. And then we'll be joined by Peter Hoffman and his wife, Susan, of Back 40 West. And then we got Fish from Sea to Table, Evan Hanscore of Parish Hall, Brooks Headley from Del Posto will be coming out. Of course, we'll be enjoying some delicious Heritage Foods USA pork prepared by Ryan Rice, who's catered by Roberta's, and then salumis from the Heritage Meat Shop and cheeses from Ann Saxelby's Saxelby Cheesemongers representing the Essex Market. So lots of good food, lots of good drinks. We're pretty excited, I think.
Yeah, and if you're listening now and you haven't been to Roberta's for whatever reason, or you've just eaten here but haven't seen that backyard, it's a magical place, and it looks incredible, and it will look very special tonight. So,
yeah, I think actually Melissa, who runs the gardening program, actually just flew in last night. She was out in Chicago for a conference with Growing Hope, learning a little bit more about this urban garden movement and getting to talk with Will. And she actually has a little aquaponics set up back there, which I just learned this morning. There's a small tribe of goldfish and some mint doing a little symbiotic development in the back. So we'll give you a secret tour if you're listening. Find me or Jack, because you just found out here on the main course.
Yeah.
Well, very exciting. So we're going to take a break and then come back with one of the new hosts, Clay Gordon. As I always tell him when I walk by his chocolate company, he's got one of the 27 best shows on the network. So we wanted to have him, and he is very generously hosting the VIP tour. I guess it's not a tour, just VIP party. So we'll take a break and be back in a sec. Thanks for listening.
Not again. If our lives depend on it, so political.
You're listening to Southern Pretender.
Intellectual, ineffectual. Create Southern Pretender, sister, mother, hide your children, ain't you under the pillow? Sleep on it. The man in the white shoe. Back, man in the white shoes. Southern pretender, sister, mother, it's all useless and I want you. What you're going through, it's all figment of your imagination. Come on, baby, try to save me. Come on, baby, try to save me from the man in the white shoes.
Hearst Ranch grass-fed beef, pasture-raised on 150,000 acres in Central California. Hearst Ranch grass-fed beef, free-range, sustainably produced, humane. Hearst Ranch grass-fed beef, the authentic flavor of the American West.
That's good. Great. We're going to hear a song from Brian Kenny in a second. But, you know, we're talking about shows, and one of the things they printed out for the party is, you know, a schedule and some of our best shows and some of our new shows. You know, definitely HRN has 6 or 7 shows that are really, you know, by far and away the most popular, you know, in terms of podcasting numbers and number of listeners. First is Cooking Issues, hosted by Dave Arnold. I mean, he is just an unbelievable resource on food, from the molecular level to innovative techniques and equipment and ingredients, and he can answer any question. Taste Matters, we're really honored to have Mitchell Davis from the James Beard Foundation. I really, you know, host a show called Taste Matters. He has some unbelievable guests. He's the vice president of the James Beard Foundation, and I really recommend that people listen to those shows. And, of course, if you listen, love beer, Beer Sessions Radio, hosted by Jimmy Carbone, he ends up he's probably had 500-600 microbrewery guests over the years. And then in terms of new shows, it's ironic, our highest rated show doesn't really have anything to do with food, but it's After the Jump, hosted by Grace Bonnie of Grace Bonnie, you know, Design Sponge. And she takes her love of art and design, you know, from the web basically to radio for us. And she interviews designers and store owners and up-and-coming members of the creative community. And she is very, very, very interesting. Of course, Dorothy Cann Hamilton's Chef Story, which is... Dorothy Cann Hamilton is the founder and CEO of the International Culinary Center, and here on HRN, she's actually bringing her hit PBS series and companion book, Chef Story, to heritageradionetwork.org. So, I mean, she has some big chefs, like from Jacques Pepin to, you know, I can't even begin to say they're each one more famous than the other, but Jacques Pepin was by far and away my favorite. But she has some big guests. I mean, if Julia Child were alive, she would have her on. So a very, very important show for the network. So I really hope people listen to those shows. And I also hope they listen to Straight from the Source, hosted by Clay Gordon, who's in studio. What's up, Clay?
Hey, Patrick. It's great to be here on a Sunday afternoon. It's beautiful here in Bushwick, and such a comparison with the monsoon we had out here yesterday. I almost had to swim here this morning. It was quite remarkable.
In fact, I was going to ask you if the tree in your logo just grew out of those rains, or if that was filmed somewhere else.
Yeah, pretty much. No.
So now you had a history with non-commercial radio in the 1970s, so talk about that.
Well, you asked the question, Brian, I was here waiting before the break, about... what they thought the radio station meant and what they thought it was doing. And I was thinking back to my own career. I mean, I spent 3 years in Portland, Oregon in the late 1970s working for a radio station, KBOO-FM, a non-commercial FM radio station, which was part of a group called the National Federation of Community Broadcasters, which meant it was community supported. It was supported by the listeners, much the same way that HRN is supported by its listeners. There were some corporate sponsorship, much as there is some corporate sponsorship right now, but it was staffed by volunteers for the most part, people who are really, really passionate about what it is they're doing, about some aspect of music, some aspect of civil justice, some aspect of what was going on. And I think that same spirit inhabits the radio station. I've been a fan of radio since the 70s and have thought about, you know, what it would be like to go back. But doing radio within the existing corporate structure, even if it's NPR or something, is very, very difficult. And you're very, very tightly constrained about what it is that you're able to talk about, what it is that you're able to play. And the great thing about this format harkens me back to the free radio days of the late 60s, early 70s. It's all about, hey, I have an idea. I'm looking for some venue that I can use to be able to get out there. And the major difference is that in Portland in 1970, we had a 50,000 watt transmitter. Mm-hmm. And if I was lucky on a good day with the wind blowing in the right direction, we might be able to make it down to Eugene or Salem. Actually, not even Eugene, to Salem. And, you know, when it was raining in the winter, you know, if we were able to get to the outskirts of Portland, that was quite remarkable. But you know, here we are 40 years later. I'm sorry to say 40 years later. And with the internet, we have a global audience. And we can take these ideas and share them not just with our friends who are near to us, but we can share them with people who are across the country and across the world.
Do you think that makes us less legitimate not to have an antenna and try to, you know, actually do it radio style versus internet style? I mean, that's kind of hardcore that you guys did that back then.
Yeah, it was really quite remarkable. There are some really fabulous stories about some of the early pioneers, especially a guy by the name of Lorenzo Milam, who, mm-hmm. in addition to being a great force in the founding of KBOO in Portland, but also Chaos FM in Olympia, trying to think of the name of the station, KRAB in Seattle, but also the Pacifica, KPFA, KPFB, right. WPFW, that whole network he was involved in. And
what's his name?
Lorenzo Milam, M-I-L-A-M. Just a really, really...
Is he still alive?
You know, I have not kept track of Lorenzo. I'll have to go look.
That's why have him on.
That's what the internet was invented for, in order to be able to find out things like that.
Yeah, Joe's like, I already know. He's like, I found that out 2 minutes ago.
But I think that the question you ask is a really, really interesting one. What it took hundreds of thousands of dollars and years back in the 60s and 70s in order to be able to buy a transmitter, because if you had to get the support, get the FCC licenses necessary to put a transmitter up. I had to actually get an FCC third class license in order to be on the air for a program, because I needed to make transmitter power readings on a regular basis. And so what the internet has done is, instead of requiring enormous amounts of money and enormous amounts of community support, what we can do is we can get four or five people together. That's all it takes, four or five people together. We need to get a decent internet connection, and now with cloud-based services where you can host stuff, man, you can have an impact around the world, and that's remarkable. And I think if you look at the impact that you're having on people's lives, on people's attitudes, that should be the measure of legitimacy, not necessarily whether or not it takes, you know, $500,000 worth of studio equipment in order to be able to do something.
Oh, absolutely. So you parlayed that kind of interest into basically traveling the world and learning about sourcing and beginnings of ingredients.
Yeah. I was lucky after I got out of college. I went from Portland, Oregon, being this itinerant radio guy, to moving to Providence, Rhode Island to get an undergraduate fine arts degree in photography, and moved to New York City. That's what one does when one wants to be a photographer after one gets done from art school. And very shortly after that, I landed a job at my first high-tech startup in 1983. And that job enabled me to travel around the world. And that's where I first really got my chance to explore my interest in food, which started at a very young age. My father and my mother were, you know, we never had white bread in the house. We almost never ate from cans. I mean, they were very early in terms of making sure that we ate well and had a healthy attitude about food. And so traveling enabled me to learn more about foodways. And when I had my inspiration, my entrepreneurial epiphany, or moment of madness, depending on who you speak to, when I had that first interest, got my first interest in chocolate, my traveling allowed me to go all over. Mm-hmm. And the sort of artist's inquiry, of, you know, just going in and saying, this doesn't make sense, I need to see the pattern, I need to go and, you know, do something creative with this, just opened up my eyes to this whole world that, you know, I had only known as a consumer before, but going literally to the source and learning how this stuff gets made.
So you talk about, obviously, fair and ethical sourcing through engaged dialogue with participants in every link of the supply chain. Mm-hmm. So what percentage of the total supply would you call ethical?
Well, the world's harvest last year is about 3 million metric tons.
Okay.
Just to give you an idea, it's the smallest commodity traded on the commodities market. I mean, coffee, I believe, is number two. Oil is number one. And there are many, many times. The market price right now is about $7 billion, right, in terms of the size of the commodity market. It's really, really tiny. Of that, you're talking about less than 1%.
Really?
Less than 1% of the market is could be considered.
Because it's funny, here in America, you know, you see Starbucks and, you know, their chocolates. I mean, and right. You know, all these chain stores declaring certain things, and right. You think it's bigger than it is, I guess.
No, it's unfortunately, it's a very small percentage of the market. Mm. And even though it's a very small percentage of the market, overall, the whole concept of the fair trade movement has become very big business. And so many of the same economic factors which have led to the dilution of the organic standard, mm-hmm. right, are beginning to creep in, and people are beginning to make decisions about fair trade and ethical sourcing based more on the business decisions of the companies that stand to benefit from the use of the symbol, the use of the logo on packaging, rather than, in fact, what is best for the farmers. I mean, one of the things that came out, I had Dr. Christy Leslie, who has a PhD in women's studies with a focus on chocolate, looking at the impact of fair trade and ethical sourcing on both producers and consumers of chocolate. And she pointed out that although fair trade, you're supposed to pay the world market price plus a premium, the question is, who gets paid the world market price? So the largest fair trade cooperative in the world is in Ghana, a cocoa cooperative in the world, Kuapikoku. And the deal that the cocoa farmers have with the Ghanaian government sets the price for cocoa every year, is that the farmers get paid 70% of the world's price. Okay, well, that leads a very, very interesting question. If the farmers are supposed to be getting paid, or the cooperative is supposed to be getting paid the world market price, and the Ghanaian government says, you only get 70%, which is in fact true. And if you actually look at the finances, and you know, this is a real issue for people. You know, I'm trying to find a really good forensic accountant to be able to go look through the financial statements and say, hey guys, you know, are you actually reporting anything that bears a resemblance on reality? You know, I've been in correspondence with the people at FLO, the Fair Trade Labeling Organization, in Bonn, and they said, well, you know, we can't give you reliable figures on the money that is being paid in fair trade premiums by country. And I'm going, how could that possibly be the case? You've been doing this for 10 years, and you're all about giving money. No. And how come you can't keep track of it? So it's a big problem.
And, I mean, is the Ghanaian government using that 30% for marketing or something like that?
Well, that depends on who you talk. Well, they're using it to manage some infrastructure. So there are warehouses that are put together. There's a government ministry. So there is some overhead associated with it. Ghana produces 40% of the world's supply. So of the 3 million metric tons, they produce 1.2 million metric tons. If there's $2,000 a ton, that's a couple of billion dollars. 30% of they are. Does it cost $600 million to run the infrastructure of Ghana? I don't think so.
For the grower of fair trade product in the chocolate business, what's the premium that they get?
The premium right now is $200 per metric ton of dry weight,
mm-hmm.
At the farm gate where the product is purchased. But interestingly enough, that premium is not paid to the farmer.
Yeah.
The premium is paid to the cooperative.
Right.
Right. And the cooperative then gets to decide how that money gets spent.
Yeah.
Some of it could be given to the farmer directly, right? But most of it is used for infrastructure projects of one form or another. So building a school, building a community hospital or medical clinic, building drawing pads to support. I mean, there are all ways that it can be spent. And, you know, fair trade encourages, the Fair Trade Organization encourages spending in a bunch of different directions, but does not require that the money gets spent in any particular fashion.
Right. Right. So I guess the question I'm trying to get to is, what's the bottom line impact for the producer to grow it in a fair trade system as opposed to unfair trade?
Right. The normal system. Yeah, conventional. The normal. Well, like, we have conventional and organic, you have conventional yes. and fair trade. And I would say that it depends on a cooperative by cooperative basis, right. and depends on historically. So, for example, and I try only to speak from personal experience. Mm-hmm. So I was down in Belize for the first time in 2007, where I got introduced to the cooperative, the Toledo Cacao Growers Association, which is the first cooperative in the world that was both fair trade and organic certified. And their largest customer was Green and Blacks. Mm-hmm. And all the cocoa that got produced by the TCGA was put into Green and Blacks Maya Gold Bar, because the cocoa came from Mayan farmers. Mm-hmm. Right? Although Green and Blacks didn't buy all the cocoa they needed for Maya from the farmers, they had a deal that says, you bring us cocoa, we'll buy it. And the program worked because Green and Blacks paid to have a representative on the ground in Punta Gorda 24/7, 365 days a year. So in addition to paying the farmers the fair trade premium, the organic premium, right, and everything else they did, is they took it upon themselves to make sure that there was a representative making sure that everything was done right. according to the right. rules. Mm-hmm. So a couple of years ago, people don't know this, but Green and Blacks got purchased by Cadbury.
Oh, wow.
And when Green and Blacks got purchased by Cadbury, that happened just after the guy who was overseeing the program down in Belize unfortunately died of a heart attack. And he wasn't replaced.
Oh, wow.
Right? And so I went back there afterwards, and you see really subtle shifts in the power balance. And then Cadbury got purchased by Kraft. And so all of a sudden, there's this whole different approach to organic. Yeah. So whereas before, Green and Blacks would purchase all the transitional organic stuff mm-hmm. and sell it into the conventional market or use it for their own conventional market and separate it in their warehouse. When Kraft came in, they stopped buying transitional organic
oh, wow.
because all of a sudden they have a different certifier.
Right.
They're no longer a European certifier. They want a North American certifier.
Right.
So, you know, it's even though you've read the label once, if you buy the product over the course of a couple of years,
right.
you need to continue to read the label
because yeah,
sure. stuff changes.
Well, who do you have on your show this week? Your shows are on
Wednesday at 3 o'clock. Wednesday at 3 o'clock. The scheduled guest is a gentleman by the name of Martin Christie. Martin and I started probably the first two professional chocolate blogs in the world almost exactly the same time back in 2001. His is called 70%.com, and he runs it out of London. He's here in New York this week because the North American judging round for the International Chocolate Awards started yesterday and today, and then the final judging is on tomorrow, Wednesday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday.
Okay.
And so I'm hoping to be able to get Martin here on Wednesday to be able to talk about what it means to put together an international competition to try to find some of the best chocolates in the world and, you know, what their attitudes are towards, or if there is anything in the awards which talks about not just fine cocoa, but cocoa which is, in fact, produced fairly, or wow. chocolate that's made fairly.
Fantastic. Well, thanks so much for being on. Thanks to all our guests, Aaron Fairbanks, Katie Kiefer, Jack Inslee. Thanks to Joe Galarraga for producing. But we want to have Brian. It's 12:45 now. You have until 12:50 to take us to places that we could only dream okay. about through song. So thanks for listening. And here is Brian Kenny, an American artist.
All right. Well, it's good to be out here in Bushwick. I didn't want to check my email. I never got past the password. I wanted to build a future.
but I never got past my past. Wanted to be loved, but I never could love myself. I thought I made a mistake once, but I was wrong. But I couldn't embrace the now. You know it's called the present, 'cause it's a gift from God. And a friend named Jared Tyson taught me that. And I do believe I've been trying to learn that about every single day. But the way I see it now with new eyes, I should feel gratitude each and every day. And I should endeavor to hold on to that gratitude, no matter what unpleasantness comes my way. Comes my way, Lord, Lord, comes my way. Comes my way, Lord, Lord, comes my way. Comes my way, Lord, Lord, comes my way. No matter what unpleasantness comes my way. I never had the working man blues till my check was already spent. I never knew easy come could easy go till it done gone and went. And I get so impatient, how soon is now? You know I'm channeling Exene Cervenka, you know I must not think bad thoughts. But my eyes are bloodshot now, even though they're new eyes. And I'm getting lost in the toothy fog, but I'm making good time. And I'm hoping that I'm due for a karmic boost, 'cause I've had more than my share of unpleasantness this time. Made a supreme being of your choosing, ease my mind. Ease my mind, Lord, Lord, ease my mind. Ease my mind, Lord, Lord, ease my mind. Made a supreme being of your choosing, ease my mind.
Oh, thank you, boys.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.